The Tom Woods Show, episode 2049.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, I had a bit of an emergency around the house today, and so I was planning to release something fresh that I would just have recorded this morning, but it was just not possible to do it. So, rather than leave you orphans with no Tom Woods Show episode, I am releasing instead an appearance that I made very recently on the Bitcoin Standard podcast, which is Saifedean Ammous's podcast, which shares the same name with his book, The Bitcoin Standard. So he's a great and brilliant Austrian economist who's well-known in Bitcoin circles. But we talk about a wide variety of topics. In fact, I honestly don't remember if Bitcoin even comes up in the conversation. But I hope you enjoy this. It's a little on the long side, so it's appropriate for the weekend. And here we go. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard podcast today. Our guest today is Professor Tom Woods, a prolific author in Austrian economics and a very active online presence, worked with the Mises Institute and has published an enormous number of works on Austrian economics. He also has his own podcast, and he also runs his own educational institute, online education. So Tom and I share quite a lot in this regard. We're all doing the same things. And in fact, we also share the fact that we both went to Columbia University. That's where Tom did his PhD. Was it your PhD or your undergraduate you did there?
It was PhD. What years were you there?
I was there long after you. I was there 2004 to 2009.
I left in 1999.
So you did your PhD in history in Colombia, right?
I did.
Yeah. I did mine in sustainable development. But, you know, as you can imagine, listeners, Colombia is not exactly the most hospitable place for people who think about things like Austrian economics, like Tom and I. And after that, Tom has, I must say, you know, it's not purely coincidence that we do similar things. It's very largely also due to inspiration. I've looked at him and always wanted to copy him. When I wanted to grow up, I wanted to be Tom Woods. I remember when I first started getting into Austrian economics, I'd wanted to write, and I always would get ideas about something that I would want to write, and then Tom Woods would have a book about it already. And I'd read the book, and it's already there, and there's just basically nothing for me to add. I remember Meltdown. Like, I thought maybe it might be worth writing something about that, but then you published Meltdown before I could get the draft written out and saved me the trouble. So I'm very happy to be talking to Woods today. He's had me on his podcast before, but now I have him here. So welcome.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
So I guess to begin with, can you tell us a little bit more about your background, how you got into Austrian economics? You know, how do you go from Colombia to Austrian economics? The question everybody always asks me. Let's ask it to you today.
Right. Well, I was already into it before I got to Columbia. I guess I grew up, I was all wrong on so many things when I was younger, but that's true of so many of us, right? When I was in high school, I knew I was not a left liberal and I knew I was not a communist. But other than that, I was all confused. So I guess I thought of myself as belonging to the U.S. Republican Party. And so I would make excuses for every crazy and idiotic thing they did. And as time went on, I decided, especially once I went to undergrad, I was actually at Harvard undergrad, and there was a lot of craziness in that town, Cambridge, Massachusetts. There were literal communists selling a communist newspaper outside the dining hall at the college, and I would engage with them. I just couldn't believe these people existed, and it radicalized me to the point where I decided, look, either I have principles or I don't. I'm either going to be all or nothing. If I believe in private property, I'm going to believe it the whole way. So I was inclined to think, you know, I want whatever these people are, I want to be the opposite. And so what began to happen was I started to attend different libertarian events that I would find out about through ads in magazines. This is the early 1990s. I'd find out about them through ads in magazines. So the Institute for Humane Studies, and then Mises Institute has the Mises University Summer Program. And for that, I knew a little bit about what Austrian economics was, but not a whole lot. And they give you a lot of readings to prepare for the event. I read everything cover to cover. I was ready to go. I spent a week. I met Murray Rothbard. And after that, I was just a goner. Like, this is for me. So that was kind of where I got my feet wet. And then I went to Columbia. And Columbia is even more inhospitable as of place. But I was busy with my graduate work, so that was okay. But the consolation is that when you're at an elite school and you believe things that are out of the mainstream, the consolation is all the books you might be curious to read are all just sitting collecting dust on the shelf. You never have any problem with the books being checked out. No one's checking the books out. You can get any book you want anytime you want.
Yeah. I guess it's kind of similar in my case, but in my case, no, I did not go to Columbia knowing about Austrian economics. So I wonder, why is it that you chose to go to Columbia if you were interested in Austrian economics? So was it that you wanted to do this because you wanted to become an academic, or was it just intellectual curiosity?
I am primarily a historian, so I don't have degrees in economics. I'm self-taught when it comes to economics. I wanted to be an academic. That's right. I wanted to be a history professor. And at that time, Columbia had the number two history department in the country. And Harvard, where I was, might have had the number one. But the problem was I was a 20th century guy, and all their 20th century people were on sabbatical. And how am I going to have a dissertation director if it's unclear? And also they had openings, people had left, and their 20th century department was in shambles. So the number two department for me was the number one department, basically. So Columbia seemed like the place to go.
I see. And so then you did your PhD in Columbia. Then what happened that saved you from the path of being a history professor?
Well, I was one for a little while.
Okay.
But around 2006, there had been a kind of an informal position at the Mises Institute of historian in residence, and it was open, and so I put out some feelers. How would you like to have this guy? but actually, it was kind of mutual. Like, they were thinking about me, and I was thinking about them, and so I got an offer that I could come down and be at the Mises Institute in residence, and I could just work on what I wanted to work on. And occasionally, they would give me a project. I wrote the foreword to a new edition of Mises Liberalism, for example. Or there was a program at neighboring Auburn University for retirees to come and take courses at Auburn, specifically for them. And so I did a course on U.S. history at the Mises Institute for these just ordinary retirees in Auburn. So sometimes they would give me projects to work on, but in general, they just trusted me from my years of working in this area. And so I produced like a book a year while I was there. I was there for 4 years. It was a really, really productive time. In fact, so productive, I think back on it, I wonder, as I say, I could never do that. And then I realized, no, I did do it. Here are the books. It just seems exhausting thinking back on it today.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, when you're enjoying what you're doing, you just, you don't get tired. You don't get tired if you're winning, basically.
Yeah, that's true.
You just keep enjoying producing it so it doesn't annoy you. And so then, after the Mises Institute, you didn't go back to academia, right?
No, I didn't. I guess I had gotten used to not dealing with bureaucracies and committee work and rivalries within your department and PC and appeasing people. And I just didn't seem like something I wanted to do. And also, as the internet kept developing, I felt like, at least in theory, the world was potentially my classroom. I could reach a huge number of people by teaching. And as you mentioned, because I was no longer collecting a salary and I was freelancing, we moved for family reasons and for the children, I had to figure out some way to make a living. And I was given a brilliant, basically million-dollar idea by a friend of mine who said, you have this big audience and following that you've developed through your books and YouTube videos and whatever. What are you doing with that following? And I realized I wasn't doing anything. And he said, no, you can't do nothing. This is how you're going to make your living. If people like reading books that you write and they enjoy watching videos where you smash fallacies and stuff like that, well, why couldn't you develop courses in U.S. history where you're promising people that what they're going to learn in these courses is what they did not learn in school. And that's one of the things people liked about my books. Well, maybe they'd like it about courses. So I developed a full-blown kind of like dashboard university of courses with on history and economics and other fields where you can consume these courses anytime you want, 3 o'clock in the morning if you want to. They're just sitting there waiting for you. So that was how my libertyclassroom.com got developed. So I was able to, you know, at that time, I was, well, by 2014, I would have my fifth child. But by the time I started Liberty Classroom, I had 4 daughters. And I didn't really want to spend all my time doing public speaking, flying all over the country. That is one thing I'm good at. I am a good public speaker. But public speaking tears you away from the family a lot. And I just decided that was for the birds. I didn't want to do it as much. Or as my daughters got older, I would start taking them with me on these events and we would have a nice little time, make a little vacation out of it. But this allowed me to work from home and be with my daughters and spend time with the family a lot better. And also simultaneously reach a huge number of people. So it was maybe one of the best decisions I ever made was starting that site. It was a lot of initial upfront work and a lot of initial upfront money. But since that time, it's been, next year, it'll be 10 years since I created that thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely inspiring. And it's inspired me to go ahead and do the same thing, basically. So thank you for that.
So glad to hear that I was some kind of inspiration for you. Because when I went to your website, you know, I had you on the show a couple of times, I went to your website and I found out about you teaching online and stuff like that. And you've got your whole, you have a great following who they will just crawl over broken glass for you. Like you have all the ingredients you need. I thought to myself, doggone it, this is great. He is a model of what people should be doing. And so now if you say that I inspired you, I guess I was implicitly complimenting myself, but I think the way you've executed it has been so effective. And I love that when Jordan Peterson was asking, all right, who's an Austrian economist I should talk to? The barrage of people saying your name is a real vindication of the of your activity online.
Yeah, to be fair, though, I think you probably do execution 10 times better than me, but I'm kind of taking a performance-enhancing drugs in this competition, and that is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is kind of the wind in my sails. So I think, you know, my execution has been far below par. But my book, The Bitcoin Standard, became quite successful beyond my imagination, and a lot of people were reading it. So a lot of people just keep coming to my Twitter and to my website, and I'm trying my best to, as you say, like it's a no-brainer. If your business model usually is you do those things in the analog meat space where you're trying to teach and write, well, you could do it with 1,000x the productivity if you do it online. The world is your classroom. There's a much bigger audience, and there's a the time you spend getting in taxis and airports and flying around is time that you can double, triple, quadruple your output, and then you can spread it to many, many, many multiples of the number of students. You know, when you're at the university, you deal with 20 students, 50 students, 200 students a semester maximum. It's a very limited scope for how much you can influence them. But then when you do it online, and because it is more productive, it is also more economically rewarding. It just naturally follows. And that's the kind of thing that you learn from learning Austrian economics, that, yeah, if people enjoy what you're doing, then, you know, that's your market signal right there, telling you that, that they want more of it and you should be out there doing it and doing more of it.
You know, for all the struggles we have these days, sometimes important videos get taken down and people get deplatformed. Even acknowledging all those problems, it still has been an unbelievably liberating experience for me to be able to use this medium to, as I say, reach a lot of people, to make my living. And I don't have to deal with any boss either. I don't have to worry that he's going to make some unreasonable demand of me all of a sudden. I don't have to worry about mandates. I am in command of my own destiny. And you can't put a price tag on that. And thankfully, I don't have to put a price tag on it, because making my own, in my own destiny, I make way, way, way more than I ever did in academia. So works out well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something that the internet really introduces that wasn't the case up until the internet came about. And I think not just the internet came about, I think it wasn't the case up until really the last 10 years or so. Before then, if you wanted to be an intellectual, you had to be reliant on these centralized institutions. You couldn't just be an authority if you didn't have, you know, the establishment seal of approval, whether it came from academic institutions. You were at one of the top universities, so you'd ticked all of the boxes for political correctness and, you know, ideological status conformity. But also, you needed to have, or, you know, you could have had like the kind of, you know, mainstream media acceptance, which gives you the platform. But it was very difficult to be a successful intellectual independent of that. You couldn't get interest in your book. You couldn't get on TV. You couldn't get on newspapers. You couldn't get into universities. Your books were very hard to market. But the internet just gets around that. And it allows you to be not just, you know, an author, but also a teacher. And you can run your own university online. And that's, I think, I mean, we're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg of the, I think, the intellectual impact this is going to have on the world that we'd had up until very recently. You know, and it's really not just, you know, the internet, it's the more recent kind of interactive social media internet, particularly Twitter and Facebook and these platforms that have facilitated this kind of interactive experience where people start spending a lot of time online and learning and acquiring these experiences. It's really going to change the dynamic of how intellectuals have functioned, because over the last century, being an intellectual was essentially, as you discuss in your work in many places, it was a status job. It was paid for by government, and so it had to arrive at the conclusions that were suitable to government. And now, because of the internet, you're witnessing an entire new class of intellectual that goes directly to consumer and doesn't need the seal of approval of authority. And you're witnessing them dwarf the you know, the official authority. Like, you see it happening on the internet that, the mainstream economists have a lot more titles, but they don't have anywhere near the kind of interaction or audience that Austrian economists get, I think, online.
Without a doubt. And now these days, this platform Substack, which I don't use. I have my own mailing list that I've had for a long time. But that's where you find a lot of the thinkers you really find engaging and interesting, you want to follow. You don't think, gee, I wonder if that New York Times columnist has a regular newsletter. And thought never crosses your mind. It's on Substack. It's all these independent people. And of course, now the traditional channels of conveying information are finding their audience shrinking. So no matter what you try to do to silence people, something pops up to give them another platform. Glenn Greenwald is doing a lot of his work over on Rumble, which is an alternative to YouTube. So these are growing pains. The internet is still a fledgling thing. And of course, we have no precedent for this. And so all of a sudden being faced with the prospect of being silenced for your opinions, this is a brand new thing. And there hasn't been time yet for entrepreneurs to catch up with that. But I feel like as all it's going to take is a few really substantial content creators who find themselves deplatformed, suddenly showing up on Odyssey or Rumble or something. And then before you know it, you're off to the races and you have a full-fledged alternative. So it's still an amazing thing to be part of. And I just love every day. I turn on my computer, I write an email to my list of 80,000+ people and nobody can stop me. And by the way, even if the service stopped me, there are a million more. And I've always got the list saved. It's in a nuclear bunker, you know, with the codes and everything. I built something that can support me, and that there's really nothing they can do about it. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. This reminds me again, you know, execution. I started a mailing list and I started collecting names, but then I redesigned the website and forgot to give it a prominent place in the new website, and the mailing list is stalling. I need to start doing that. If you go to my website, you can find it on my contact page, saifedean.com/contact. Sign up to my mailing list, but I'm kind of neglecting it. I need to start getting more active about it. It's a great tool because it's platform independent. So even if you get your account delisted, you still have the mailing list saved. You can reach the same people from another account, and it's very powerful. You know, you send lots of text straight into somebody's inbox where they get a lot of important things. So it's a very powerful tool. And I think it's just, in general, what the internet is doing is just, it's making so much more communication so much easier, and therefore really making it hard to suppress and, commoditize and manufacture consistent opinion that goes along with what the state wants.
I want to ask you something that I asked one of my guests recently. He's a professor at NYU, Mark Crispin Miller. He teaches a course on propaganda. So, of course, he's a very valuable scholar at a time like
this.
And I wonder what your thoughts are about this, because I said to him that it's like a double-edged sword, the internet these days, because on the one hand, during COVID, I would not want to be confined just to the three standard television channels we had in 1967. I would not want to rely entirely on the Washington Post and the New York Times or my local paper. And so the internet has allowed dissident voices a place to speak, even if it's a shrinking one. I've been able to get a lot of information and a lot of perspectives that would have been excluded from the mainstream had there been no internet. That's the good. But the other side is the propaganda in favor of all the things that the states around the world have been doing has been pushed out into the ether by means of the internet, so that all over the world, we see people wearing masks and we're hearing about social distancing and we're getting the same uniform message everywhere in every nook and cranny of society. They've used the internet to overwhelm us with propaganda. So I wonder on net in this situation, has the internet been a force for on net good? Or has it actually just been weaponized by states around the world to promote their fear-mongering propaganda? What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. It was probably one of the kind of biggest letdowns and disappointments for me just to witness how the tools of propaganda transferred from TV to Twitter and Facebook. Like, it was pretty incredible. You know, 2020 was the year in which your Twitter started functioning in weird ways. Like, you know, there was the time in which the retweets, the numbers of the retweets and the likes would go down, and they'd go up and down, and they'd keep fluctuating when they were suppressing specific tweets, and then there were tweets that they were promoting very clearly. It was really shocking, and I was one of the people who was very optimistic about this aspect of it, that this is it. You know, CNN is dead. All of these traditional media outlets are dead, and all of their ability to shape people's minds and turn them into unthinking cattle, it's going to be gone with the internet. And then they absolutely showed me how it's done on the internet. It's done very effectively. People get promoted, people get delisted, deboosted, and get their accounts canceled and so on. Yet still, having said that, you know, think about the alternative of actually if we'd been in 1967 or 1981, how difficult it would have been for you to get any of the kind of ideas on the COVID hysteria from any of the sources that have produced
mail. You would have had to put a check in an envelope in the mail to request somebody's newsletter that you wouldn't have known about in the first place. So there's that. But then on the other hand, the other edge, a third edge of the sword, is people could do school over Zoom, maybe not that effectively, but in principle, you could do school over Zoom, you could have meetings over Zoom, you could work over Zoom. Because we had Zoom, because the technology existed, it was possible for people to live these sheltered lives for a year and a half, 2 years. If that technology hadn't existed, I doubt people would have just said, well, come what may, I'm just going to crawl into a corner in my house and not make any income. It was because we had the technology that made it possible to live like hermits that we wound up being told to live like hermits. If it hadn't existed, maybe we would have learned earlier, well, you're just going to have to learn to cope with it. I wonder.
I agree
with you. I've turned into the interviewer here just for a minute, but just because I'm so curious.
No, and I'm going to want to up you here quite dramatically and tell you that I've had the same thought about literacy as a technology. So we could say the same thing about the internet and social media, but really literacy, I think, and you know, in your work, you've written about the midwit, which I plan to get into. And I think the 2020 makes a strong case for mass literacy not being a good thing, being in fact a very dangerous thing, because I think there's a class of people that are probably better off being illiterate and just receiving instruction via audio or pictorial instructions, you know, just getting clear manuals and clear recordings of text about what to do. Because if they were illiterate, they wouldn't be able to stuff their brains with extremely elaborate levels and layers of propaganda that lead them to believing extremely sophisticated nonsense, which is, you know, the kind of the people who have been very eager to take on the facets of totalitarianism over the last year. Like, a lot of them are some of the people that, you know, they play intellectuals on the internet. You'd think they've got functioning brains, you know, they use big words and they write books and they have an audience. And you listen to them, and all that they do is their literacy is just a tool for them to receive propaganda and then to rationalize propaganda and communicate it to others. I wonder just how much better society would be if a lot of these people were not literate. I think, I'm kind of being a little cheeky here, but in a sense, we can see this happening, I think, you know, with all technologies. The same thing happens with all technologies. Literacy or the internet is the same thing. It changes everything, but at the same time, you know, we as human beings, we remain the same. And so we are the kind of...
I've often wondered about this. It's funny you say this, because I am not of the opinion that the state has our welfare at heart, right? It has its own agenda. So yet it consistently, it pushes mass literacy. And now, is that just because it cares so deeply for our ability to read, you know, Aristotle's Politics or something? And it's so funny also that I think in particular, like people who tend to go to school board meetings, and a lot of them are moms, so I was thinking that like that, but who are always emphasizing how important education is, and you've got to get your education. We have to spend more on education. And then I look at them, well, what are they reading? You know, now that they're out of school, what are they reading? If they're reading anything, it's some trashy novel they picked up at the convenience store. Like, they're not reading, you know, Plato's Republic, right? They're not reading propositions from Wittgenstein, right? So what was the point? You know, why you have this gift of being able to comprehend the written word, and you're going to either not use it or you're going to use it for something entirely pointless. And at the same time, you're going to jump up and down about how important education is, when in your own life, you obviously couldn't care less about it.
Yeah, that's very profound. I mean, it's echoing to an extent the debate about the internet, and I think the debate about Bitcoin, that reading is an extremely sophisticated technology. Like, you can just pack a few hundred grams of paper with tens of thousands of words, and that can contain extremely complex ideas that could change somebody's life for the better or for the worse. You know, just because you read it doesn't mean it's a good thing. You could be reading things that are destructive. You know, Karl Marx's writings have destroyed the lives of tens of millions of people around the world. So I think, yeah, I mean, I could kind of sympathize with the idea that perhaps this is just not a technology that should be. It's just like, you know, not everybody should be driving a car. There are clear qualifications required and clear conditions in which you should be. And, you know, you shouldn't be drunk, you shouldn't be sick, you shouldn't be... you shouldn't have certain impediments toward driving a car. I think perhaps literacy might be one of these.
Well, that's probably the most controversial avenue I've gone down in my podcasting career, is what we just said here.
Yeah, well, you know, we've still got plenty of time to...
let's see if we can top that, right?
Let's see if we can top that. So I guess, you know, our best shot would be to segue from this into the COVID hysteria, where you've produced an endless... stream of extremely powerful material to expose the kind of unique lens of absurdity that we have gone through over the last couple of years. So you've written in the book, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. And you've also given a great lecture called The Fact-Free COVID Dystopia, which got pretty popular on YouTube. And then I think it was removed. Was that the case?
One of them was removed. I think that one's still up. I had a video called The COVID Cult. And that one just went berserk. I mean, between Facebook and YouTube, it was at about 1.5 million views until they finally took it down. And the reason they took it down, and I have been speaking and having videos on YouTube for as long as I can remember. I've never had one taken down. And it was taken down, they said, because of, you guessed it, medical misinformation. Well, what possible misinformation could there be in the talk? And it was, and so I actually did an episode of the Tom Woods Show in which I reviewed the fact-checking against me. And it was things like I was claiming that there was very little acknowledgement of the collateral damages due to lockdowns by the public health establishment. I don't think that's even debatable. And the best they were able to come up with, oh, that's not true. In October, the World Health Organization, in October, this thing started in March. And the best you can come up with is, well, 7 months later, they were right on. Yeah, after they destroyed the world, they suddenly realized this might be destructive. So it was inane nitpicking things like that that meant that no one was allowed to see it anymore. So I put it on, you know, other platforms and I posted it on my website and stuff like that. My more recent ebook is called COVID Charts CNN Forgot. And I'm actually very happy with that title because I didn't want to make it be like liberal, conservative, libertarian, because there shouldn't be politics in this. But as soon as you say COVID charts CNN forgot, you know exactly what I'm talking about. These are charts that are difficult to reconcile with the scaremongering. So I have a little site, chartstheyforgot.com. And that's how you can get. It doesn't cost anything. I just give that away. And it's hard, by the way, to put together a book of charts and have it look attractive. So there were a lot of work went into that. And so this is interesting both from the COVID standpoint and from what you and I were talking about before about marketing yourself and trying to, you know, make your way in the world online. I would, in these talks that I gave on these topics, promote one of these ebooks and say, look, I've got a lot more detail in here. Like I've got all the details on the ways lockdowns are deadly. I've got like 9 or 10 specific areas that are just been devastating. And I would refer people to one of these ebooks. And so given that these videos got a ton of views, I got a lot of people opting in for the ebook. I doubled my mailing list. It was all great. And the mailing list I send out, it's not meant to be just a COVID mailing list, but over the past couple of years, that's what it's turned out to be. Because that's what people are just craving. They want reliable information. They want the numbers. They want the graphs. They want to see with their own eyes what's going on. We can theorize all day long about what's going to stop the virus, but the numbers don't lie, and they want to see it. The problem that has arisen now is that before a video taking down the conventional wisdom on COVID has a chance to get traction, it's already been banned. And so that model for building up your mailing list doesn't quite work anymore. I mean, you can post on these alternatives to YouTube, but the audience is just not as robust there just yet. But that is something I did. So for example, I would say, I'm going to tell you one other thing I did. I actually made a website because I was tired of seeing all these charts that tell the story, but no one's seen the charts. So I made a website. I made a quiz out of it. So it's covidchartsquiz.com. You don't have to opt in or anything to go do it. You can just go do it. So COVID charts with an S, quiz.com. And the idea of it is we'll take a chart and we'll say, all right, this is a chart from mid 2021. And these are the numbers for where the Midwestern American states have been going in terms of their COVID results. Now, one of these states is Iowa. And Iowa removed all its state level restrictions back in February. Can you pick out, without any of these lines being labeled, which line represents Iowa's numbers? And of course you can't, because it's exactly the same as all the other places. You can't pick out Iowa. And that chart alone could be the whole website, because if you can't pick out Iowa, then this was all for nothing. Because Iowa, if it really did drop all its state-level restrictions, should be a basket case. And as a matter of fact, The Atlantic ran an article about Iowa called Iowa, the state that doesn't care if you live or die. And yet the numbers kept on going down and down and down, and you cannot distinguish it from, oh, then I did another Midwestern thing. I said, pick out where on this graph, because I'm not giving you any of the timelines, pick out where Thanksgiving is. That's where we have a lot of gatherings in people's homes. That's where there's supposed to be big outbreaks. And so after Thanksgiving, there should be a little period before people finally start to experience hospitalization and death. So you should expect to see a bit of a spike shortly after Thanksgiving. So in light of that, look at the chart of all of the Midwestern states and pick out where you think Thanksgiving is. And it's not anywhere where you would think it would be. And it's just that this kind of result is replicated over and over and over again. So again, it's COVID charts with an S, quiz.com. What is the explanation for this? Even I'm admitting I don't quite understand it, but that's really all I wanted the public health establishment to say, is that we don't fully understand what's going on. It may be 10 years before we figure this whole thing out. We don't even know if what we're recommending to you is even doing any good. We don't know for sure. Just be honest, be humble, have some humility. That was what I wanted from you.
Yeah, it's pretty startling. You look at these charts, and it's quite a testament to the power of brainwashing and the dangers of literacy. Don't try literacy at home, kids. Don't try it without proper adult supervision. That people can just, they're told on CNN and on Twitter and on Facebook that... if you implement this new kind of voodoo, then things will get better. You know, the virus gods will laugh down on us and spare us death and suffering and carnage. And there's no amount of evidence that can shake somebody's faith in that, because it doesn't matter. There's no kind of congruence with reality that is required for this faith to continue, because it's just, as you mentioned, the example of Iowa, you show them, all right, well, this is what these genocidal maniacs in Iowa decided to do to their people by letting them, live normally. And there we see nothing different. Like how difficult would it be to fake Iowa's numbers so that it would match Illinois and look exactly like Illinois? It's very difficult to be able to rig this and fake it to make the graphs look like each other. It's very difficult to imagine that it's a coincidence that they look like each other and that, things would have been so much worse in Iowa that we end up with the same numbers as Illinois and the same shape to the curve. And then you see these with the regional curves, the whole region does the same thing. And yet, the onus to believe in the effectiveness of these interventions is that you're basically saying, yes, these things are effective. And if they weren't used, things would have been so much worse. But the fact that they were used has made Iowa indistinguishable from all of the rest of its neighbors. It's incredible.
And then you'll get things like you try to talk about the reasonable success Sweden has had. I mean, Sweden is 56th in terms of death rate, 56th in the world. Now, we were told that by June of 2020, the imperial model said if they didn't have a full lockdown, they'd have 96,000 deaths by June of 2020. They had 4,000, so that was off by a factor of 24. And so then you try and, remember, the way people were screaming about Sweden should be number one in the world, shouldn't it? I mean, it should be at least in the top five. They need to explain. Of course, no one will ever call them who count on it. Why would it be 56? Why wouldn't it be 3 or 4 or 5? If it's 56, then there was no point to any of it. And sometimes you bring this up and they'll say, well, Sweden is more sparsely populated. But, the same people who say that are the same people who said everybody in Iowa would die if they didn't have lockdown. But Iowa is also sparsely populated. When Iowa lifted its restrictions, the hysterics weren't saying, oh, don't worry, everybody, it'll be fine. They're sparsely populated. They don't even need the restrictions.
Exactly.
So they're inconsistent from one country and place to another. Whatever needs to be said to keep the panic going is what they'll say.
Yeah, and that's a great example, which is how these rationalizations only appear after the thing invalidated what they had predicted would happen. Like you knew Iowa was sparsely populated beforehand. One of my favorite was there was a guy I remember on Twitter who was repeating something about the fact, well, there's something about a Swedish genetic mutation that makes them somehow magically less susceptible to being damaged by this virus. Well, why wasn't anybody saying that this was the case beforehand? It's amazing. You know, you'd think the approach that would, the really scientific approach would be, well, let's let everybody, you know, as everybody does what they think is best, we can then compare and see what happens. We can then see if it's actually Swedish genetics that are saving you from COVID, because let's say, you know, Swedish descendants in Minneapolis are living in somewhat similar weather with similar genes to the Swedes of Sweden. And if they're witnessing worse rates, then maybe the genes don't matter. If they're witnessing similar magical protection, then maybe, yes, your genetic therapy plan is good. And then we know that Swedish people are good to go. You know, they don't need to engage in any of this nonsense. Maybe if Iowa is sparsely populated, then places with the population density of Iowa don't need to engage in all this insanity. They can just get on with their life. But no, everybody has to follow everything. All of the facets of the entire cult, you know, everything from the masks to the hand washing to the just all of the rituals that make you a decent person in the 21st century.
Well, let me jump in and say about, because I've been following this so closely since the beginning. Another place they were screaming about from the beginning, by April of 2020, and when I say they, I'm talking about the people. I like the term the lizard people, because that just sums up the establishment around the world, the lizard people. The lizard people were all up in arms that Japan, Tokyo in particular, was not locking down hard enough. They were issuing recommendations and this and that, but they weren't really doing a hard lockdown. And I, at one point in my newsletter, I compiled some of the headlines about how, you know, Japan's going to get it good and hard, or too little, too late, whatever. And then Japan has, I don't know, what is 150 per million or whatever. I mean, some crazy, insanely low rate. And so then we got, well, you know, the Japanese, they wash their hands a lot, and they wear masks or whatever. But as you would say, we knew that before. We knew that in April of 2020. You knew that then. So why didn't you say, oh, they're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. They're going to be fine. No. So they had to come up. The excuses had to be excuses drawn from the cult. It had to be masks, because what else could it be? There can't be any other. It must be masks. It must be this or that. Or they weren't gathering in crowds. You can see photographs of the Japanese subway system. These people are packed in like sardines through this thing. So again, all we're asking is for you to say, you know what? We would love to say that the virus is just cartoonish, and if you do this, you'll stay safe. And if you do that, but it turns out that there are too many counterexamples in the world for that to be the simple answer. So we're going to continue to gather as much information as we can, and we'll let you know what we find. Now, of course, that is not what they want to say. The public health establishment, which is ignored most of the time, they're issuing statements about whether, you know, they're the ones who come out with the food pyramid in the U.S., telling you need to have 11 servings of grain a day. These are people we just ignore all the time, right? Most of the advice, nobody pays any attention to it at all. Or don't eat eggs, or don't eat red meat, and then they change their minds. This is their time to shine. They are not going to give this up. If this is the last thing they do, they're going to hang on to this thing like grim death.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's an entire class of society that basically is thriving from this, which is people that have always had the problem of not having a life that meets their expectations from life. You know, their job is not important enough, and the world doesn't respect them enough. People don't listen to them enough. People don't care about them enough, their own family, their own friends. And now this is your chance to just go on this moral crusade, and then you get to tell everybody what to do at all times. It's like those busybodies have just united to take over the planet from all of the happy, productive people, basically.
It gives them meaning. It gives them fulfillment. It's you're able to say that you're saving lives and being heroic while doing, and I mean the word literally here, literally nothing. By sitting in your house, you are a hero. Okay,
well, this is the only chance they'll ever get. to be fair, like to be a hero, you have to also be haranguing people on Twitter.
Haranguing people, yes. Haranguing. Good point.
But it's not quite nothing. Like this is how you get your. This is how you earn your stripes in this war of good against evil. You're out there telling all of those evil people who don't believe in Anthony Fauci and the World Health Organization, who don't believe in those people, that you should listen to those people. You know, why wouldn't you just listen to the science? The science is just one guy, and this is what the guy is saying. Why do you want to make it so complicated?
I love the science is just one guy. How hard can this be? Just listen to what he says.
I know, like it's just the scientific method. You listen to the one guy appointed by the government that benefits from this. It's very simple.
And incidentally, I just the other day, it hasn't aired yet, but I actually interviewed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for the Tom Woods Show, and he has a brand new book, very critical of Dr. Fauci, and he said, you know, there's something about this man that has made him very Teflon, no stick over the years, that no matter what he does wrong, he just escapes unscathed. And he says he has a very avuncular manner. He dresses very impressively, and he speaks in a very authoritative sounding tone, which can intimidate some people. He says, but half the time when you listen to what he's saying in that tone, it's all nonsensical or self-contradictory or makes no sense. And it reminded me, and I told him this example of, I think it was Leslie Stahl. It was some 60 Minutes reporter interviewing Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve chairman. And they were going through excerpts from his congressional testimony and hearings and stuff. And he was saying things that obviously they were words. We all knew these words, but they didn't mean anything when put side by side. But everyone in the room felt like, well, he's the expert. So we're listening to some expert testimony. And he admitted to this reporter, he used a phrase called syntax destruction to refer to what he would do, that he would just speak nonsense and sometimes, and nobody called him on it. It was just nonsensical. It reminds me of what Eisenhower said once when one of his aides did not want him to speak about a particular topic. And if it gets raised by the press, you just got to not talk about it. And Eisenhower said, don't worry, if they bring that up, I'll just confuse them. And so it seems like this is a longstanding method that these people use. And because there is this extreme deference to authority that has been drilled at least into Americans' heads, but I think also I'm hearing this also being true of quite a few Asian countries, like in the Philippines, I'm told, at least in the US, we have a minority of very well-informed people who are trying to resist this. In the Philippines, just to name an example, I'm told there is no resistance. There is nothing like that. Everybody just does what they're told. That does tremendous damage, whether it's monetary policy or Fauci or whatever else. The thought is that the expert, if they have a degree, then you have to shut up and listen to them. And now if other people with a degree disagree with them, well, I don't know, beep, bop, boop, I've been told that this is the expert I should listen to. I mean, it is.
Well, these guys have debunked on Snopes.com always.
Yeah. Yeah. And Snopes turns out there's always run by some creep after all these years, but.
Yeah, it's very interesting how in the bar that you have to clear, the onus of proof is so different for when you're regurgitating government propaganda versus when
And by the way, speaking of that, we keep hearing stories about the devastation that the supply chain problems and the lockdowns have had on the developing world, to the point where you have millions of people in a food emergency, where they could be suffering malnutrition or death from hunger, and we're the ones on whom the burden is placed to say that maybe we shouldn't do this. You would think people placing millions of people in danger of starvation, that the burden would be on them. And yet we live in such a clown world that you and I have to prove that maybe it's not a good thing to do that to people in the developing world.
Yeah, it's what's really insane about it is this idea that you need to prove that you have a good case for basically asking that these people get to make the choice themselves if they would rather stay home or, you know, starve at home or take the risk of going outside and contracting this supposedly massively lethal virus, which is basically not a problem for most people. So, you know, the, like it's this monomaniac thought, and we've had this discussion about with this author of the book, Paul Freiters, who discusses it as just a case of mass hysteria and a mass psychosis where everything else loses importance. You know, all the other things that you could care about in life are just now completely inconsequential. The only thing is we need to bring down the number of people who are going to die from the virus. And all other considerations at this point are just completely gone. People don't think about opportunity costs. People don't understand the concept of there's a real cost to it. You know, if you want to lock people at home, all right, they might not contract your virus. If we assume that your voodoo is correct and that, you know, you can just stop the spread that way, well, there's going to be a cost. Now, is that cost worth it? Is staying home worth it? Well, if you work from Zoom, then probably it is for you because there's very little loss when you do your work from Zoom. But for many people, it's a loss of their livelihood. And it could mean, you know, you don't have enough food on your table. It could mean that you can't make your house payments and you lose your house and you live on the street. It can mean very devastating things for all kinds of different people who might be willing to take their risks. I mean, really, if you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s and in decent shape, you're basically not going to suffer serious consequences from this illness. You have to weigh that risk versus the risk of financial ruin. And that's just become completely impossible in most people's mind. It's astonishing. It's astonishing the depth of economic ignorance that people just don't think this is an even valid choice for people to be able to make for themselves. No, you know, the government just decides what needs to be done.
Yeah, and also the idea that the experts should just be listened to. There's no expert who can tell you what your life priority should be. That's a category mistake to expect that from an expert. And likewise, which of these experts whose you know degrees are pointed to all the time as evidence of why we should listen to them, which one of them took a class on how to balance collateral damages from lockdowns against any progress you might make against a virus? Of course, there is no such class. And one reason that there's no such class is that nobody ever recommended lockdowns. They were always said to be a bad idea. So you have just as good an opinion on this as Dr. Fauci or anybody else. They have no particular insight into this question because no one's taught them anything about it. You have to think about it. You have to think about what you value, and you have to use common sense and say, well, probably there'll be more suicides. Probably there'll be more... there'll be missed screenings for various diseases. There'll be people with preventable ailments that could probably wind up dying under a lockdown regime. And you can just go on and on and on. Just think about it. Common sense. Think of the effects on children who will be devastated by this and on and on and on. You could fill it in yourself. You don't need to wait for an expert because the experts have no unique insight into this question. And also, I guess I thought people enjoyed their lives more than I guess they really do. You would think that a normal person would say, well, geez, if I'm going to be indefinitely in my house, is there any chance that maybe we're overreacting? I mean, maybe I should look around and see if there's anybody who dissents from this. And if there is, I'm going to see if that person has a good point. You would think people would do that because they value their life. They enjoy doing things. And it shocks me how little curiosity they've had. Oh, well, this one guy says I got to stay in the house, so I guess I'll just do it. What? You're not even going to fight? You're not even going to look?
Yeah, it's truly astonishing, and it's incredible to watch, you know, people like you just put out day after day, week after week of all of these just undeniable facts that cannot be reconciled with all of these dictates of the experts, and yet people continue to believe in them. And it's, as you said, you know, there is no other expert on my own life, and yet people have completely delegated the aspect of what I should decide for others, which is just insane because you might think, all right, well, I don't know enough about virology or I don't know enough about climate or economics or monetary policy to make those decisions for myself. So I trust the experts. You're just making the decision, but you have you've made the decision in which expert you trust. So you may as well understand that you are making the decision and that there is no alternative for you but to think about this. Like this is kind of the dangerous thing that comes with, mass literacy. It's this idea that, all right, well, then I can just read and then I'll see what the people who know how to write are saying. And then they will be the ones that are correct. It's just like such an easy attack vector on people's brains that you outsource your thinking ability to people who have titles. And then life is just about an attempt. Your life is just a matter of who manages to get the most inspiring expert ahead of you, in front of you. And then that's your life. That's your calling. That's your lot. That's why you came onto this world. That's why your mom spent 9 months being pregnant, to bring you onto this world to follow the instructions of the first guy with the right credentials to be flashed in front of your screen for you to just spend your life following them.
Well, look, I've come to the conclusion. Well, I'll say this. This professor, Martin Kulldorff at Harvard Medical School, he's been one of the dissenting voices on COVID. And I like him, and he's great, and he's gone from being, when I would first have him on the show, it would be, well, Dr. Fauci is an expert in his particular field, but blah, 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 blah. And now it's like, Fauci's a disaster. I mean, I've watched him radicalize, and that makes me happy. He tells me, Kulldorff, that a majority of infectious disease epidemiologists did not favor the mass lockdown, that they favored a more targeted approach where you would try to make special provision for people who were particularly at risk, but otherwise let everybody else go about their lives. Those are people I talk to every day, infectious disease epidemiologists, and that was their view. Now, that may well be, and that would be great if that were the case, but let's just say then, stipulating for the sake of argument that he's right, at the very least we can say that there is a very loud minority of epidemiologists who, I don't want to say they're mentally ill, but it seems to attract quacks and hypochondriacs and I don't know what, because I think it was the Washington Post that did a survey of a bunch of epidemiologists and asked them, which of these following things are you willing to do in the age of COVID? And by the summer of 2020, long after we knew you don't have to worry about crazy disinfecting everything. It's not spreading through surfaces. That's not anything you need to worry about. One third of the epidemiologists polled were afraid to check their own mail because they thought they'd get COVID from their mail. So, after a while, if at the beginning of this thing, I thought, okay, well, we have some experts who are pretty, who are saying something different and they need to be, we need to listen to them. And I do want to listen to the Martin Kulldorffs of the world. But I didn't realize that some of the people in this field, I think they may just be twisted. I mean, that's not normal. You're afraid to check your mail? Your mail. You think the virus is going to jump off the mail and you're going to get it that way. These are the ones we're supposed to be listening to. I think there might be something wrong with them. And then I saw Michael Osterholm, who is an expert on influenza, been studying it for 40 years. And he was temporarily a Biden administration advisor on COVID. Now, he occasionally has uttered a truth here and there. Like, for example, he says that the masks most people are wearing don't do anything. They're completely pointless. These masks most people have on, it's like you're in a submarine and you're going to close 3 out of your 5 windows and think that the water's not going to get in. Like, so these universal masking, he was not convinced of. Okay. But he also said recently that in terms of our understanding of viruses and how they transmit, he said, let's be honest, we are still in the Stone Age when it comes to that. We don't know as much as we think we do. And I think this experience we've lived through is ample evidence of that. Because you'll recall, I followed the U.S. case very closely, when they opened up massive outdoor sporting events, Dr. Fauci was saying, well, I don't know, I wouldn't advise that. Nothing happened as a result of it. Nothing was traced to that, no problem. Well, maybe there's something cartoonish away in their understanding of all this. I don't know. Again, I'm not claiming I have all the answers. I'm just saying I'm looking at the charts and it looks like we may have ruined a lot of people's lives for no reason. That's where I am.
And it looks like if there was any justice in the world, we'd ruin the livelihoods of all epidemiologists. Like, I think it's impossible to come away with the idea that this is a discipline that tries to look at the data and tries and understands the world. This is just a bunch of propaganda delivered from high up above. And I think, you know, I've seen Kuldroff, I think is probably him and this other guy who was in a New York-based university. He has a Polish name, Kurt something, I forget the name. He's been canceled from the internet and he lost his job. So he may as well not exist anymore. He spoke out early on and he's just basically been canceled. And Kuldroff is harder to cancel since he's at Harvard. Yeah. And you could also say Sunitra Gupta at Oxford, I think. She's also been an epidemiologist who's been not completely unhinged. So you could look at these and say, all right, well, you know, there's bad epidemiology and there's good epidemiologists and kind of like there's good economists and bad economists. But I think I'd go a little bit further. I'd make the case that epidemiology is not like economics. Epidemiology is like macroeconomics. It's the pseudoscience aspect of economics. It's like the, it's in the same way that all macroeconomists are basically charlatans. You have to be a charlatan to be an epidemiologist. If you think diseases have to function based on aggregate numbers, I just think the entire founding premise of the field is nonsensical. The idea that, all right, well, there's a disease and we need to figure out what this disease's R0 is. And I've been thinking about this for a while as a topic for a debate. I'd like to get an epidemiologist and debate them on the proposition that epidemiology is harmful for humanity. Because all of the information that comes out of it is at best useless, but most likely extremely harmful. So let's imagine an alternative reality in which all the world's epidemiologists were engaged in doing something actually useful. You know, they had real jobs producing things of value for humanity, and nobody studied epidemiology. And this whole virus situation happened, and we didn't have a single virologist, single epidemiologist to give us their opinion and their models. So we wouldn't have had models, we wouldn't have had the panic. And now, what would we have missed? So like, what actionable information would you have missed out on because of the uninvention of the field of epidemiology? So there's all these estimates about how many people are going to die in your country. None of these estimates has matched with reality. You know, there are all these projections of the curve, it's going to go up at this rate, or the R0 is going to go at that rate. And then you look at the reality of the curves, you know, there's basically nobody who could have predicted what things looked like. We've had several waves, and then the numbers are all over the place. You can't really fit them with one of these neat theories where, you know, epidemiologists just sat there and said, all right, it's an R0 of this much, so we run it through the population, and this is what we're going to be getting. It had nothing to do with reality. And in fact, I think it's not just irrelevant, it's really dangerous because it distracts people from doing the things that could actually work. That's the dangerous thing about the conceit of epidemiology, wherein we know what works to prevent bad outcomes for this virus, and it is what works to prevent bad outcomes from everything in life. It prevents bad outcomes from you, you know, sitting on your couch or driving a car or just engaging in your daily life. You know, you eat well, you take care of your health, you take responsibility for your health, and you're going to do much better job protecting yourself than any of the hysterical stress that you put yourself through during the hysteria that these epidemiologists have unleashed. So you start thinking about numbers and you start thinking about, you know, 80,000 deaths next weekend, and this many people are going to die, and this many people are going to contract it, and this many people are going to be maimed by it. And you have all these massive simulations that you're looking at. And the more attention you dedicate to this, and the more you end up thinking of this as if it's just some kind of, just a pre-programmed thing that's going to rip through society. And you see a lot of the kind of socialist calculation conceit here. You know, it's a central planner's idea of how diseases work. You know, that we're going to all sign up to be getting this because of the R0, and it's gonna decimate the population based on mathematical averages with no regard for the micro, which is the individual. It's very similar to the way in which macroeconomics functions. And I think if we just did not have this entire field of knowledge, the world would be better off, because people start seeing, oh, well, people are getting sick in China with this weird new illness. You know, maybe I should watch what I eat. Maybe I should start getting more sunshine. Maybe I should start getting more exercise. And if more people did that rather than hyperventilate and do all this, religious rituals, I think a lot more people's lives would have been better off. Plus, of course, there's the early treatment, which all of the epidemiologists insist on dismissing because they don't make money. They're not sponsored by people who sell early treatments, which don't involve profitability, because these are cheap drugs that are generic and don't have high margins. They get paid from the manufacturers of the specialized patented drugs. And so their incentive is to scare you, and their incentive is to tell you there are no alternatives but going for our sponsors. That's really, really actively destructive. And I think it's beyond just a misuse of a field. I think it's just a field that renders itself for being abused in this way, because it's all built on shaky, nonsensical foundations.
I find that very, very compelling, because I've been having the same sorts of thoughts that there's something wrong with the discipline. And of course, if you believe these things, then you're going to have you don't necessarily have to have authoritarian impulses, but they do seem to follow that since I know the trajectory of this disease, let's say, then of course it follows that because I love mankind, I have to intervene to stop its spread. And as you say, what actionable piece of information would we have been missing in the absence of this field? Well, I mean, let's think of what were the pieces of actionable information. It's wearing a mask and social distancing and all, you know, all this other stuff and lockdown and that stuff. But as we've seen, you can measure mobility, because we have, you know, people are walking around with smartphones. So there's Google mobility data. We can observe, well, when people in this state started moving around a lot and they weren't engaged in as much isolation or social distancing, does that correlate with worse results or better? And the scatter plots are just all over the place. They're not telling any story at all. You look at these numbers, they're entirely random. They shouldn't be entirely random if any of this advice worked. And of course, at this point now, some ambitious libertarian who wants to establish himself in the movement as being the go-to guy on a particular subject should look into public health in general, beyond COVID, but should just look into the idea of public health, the actual implementation of the ideas of so-called public health experts, and see if this has all been a grift the whole time also.
Yeah, I definitely think that is the case. I think it's a big, massive grift as a field, because it exists. It's perfectly tailored for authoritarianism, and it's perfectly tailored for capture by pharmaceutical companies. So I think it's just out there.
And imagine what a dangerous combination that is. Extremely powerful companies and people with sociopathic tendencies. Wow, that's quite a mix.
Yes, and I think, you know, epidemiology is kind of it is the intellectual cover that allows them to consummate their marriage and bring about this ugly dystopia in which we live, where it's, again, the giveaway is the fact that it's a science that relies on model. If your science relies on modeling, your science is not going to make it. It's a bunch of nonsense. It's fiat nonsense. It exists only because financing of science functions through the fiat spigots. So it's not a science that would exist on a free market, because nobody would pay for this hysteria. But when you have the financing of science that's coming from above, it becomes possible for these kind of pseudosciences to flourish, because you're selling your output to the government that is paying, not to the reader who wants to learn. And the government has interests that are similar, that are not identical to those of the recipient of the propaganda.
I hear you.
Hey folks, just a quick note. This episode is sponsored by Skillshare. The online learning community is offering our listeners a 1 month free trial so you can make 2022 a year of new learning, growth, and connection through creativity with online classes from Skillshare. There are so many fascinating classes on Skillshare on topics like web development, illustration, music, film and video, animation, creative writing, business analytics, entrepreneurship, and on and on. I was quite pleased with Thomas Frank's class, Mastering Productivity, Create a Custom System That Works. That's exactly what Ole Woods needs around here. So whether you're a dabbler or a pro or a hobbyist or a master, you're creative. And that's why Skillshare has classes for every skill level. With short lessons, hands-on projects, classes designed for real life, you can tap into the creativity we all have inside. Skillshare helps you move your creative journey forward without putting life on hold. You'll create real projects and get the support of fellow creatives so you can accomplish real growth. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a 1 month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods.
Another aspect to keep in mind here is that there is, with all of these sciences, there is a very strong incentive in the fiat world to go toward panicking. You have to always be Chicken Little in order to make it in fiat academia, because there's no cost to panic. There's no cost to being wrong. So yeah. Going around and saying, you know, being the Chicken Little who says, you know, the dams are going to break, the wolf is going to come and eat us, the virus is going to destroy civilization, cow farts are going to boil the oceans. There's zero downside for making any of these claims. You just go around, you make the claim, and, you know, if it doesn't come true, then it's because of you warning, or because it's, you know, it's coming true soon. And you just keep milking this forever. You can always keep milking. You can always be the hero who's fighting it. And you always require more funding. That's the only way to get more funding in fiat. Like if you write your report on cow farts in the ocean and you conclude that, yep, oceans are big enough that cow farts are not going to boil them. All right, well, then that's the end of your research career. What else are you going to work on? You know, now you need to go find some other scare to try and write about. But if you find, you know, your initial findings suggest that, oh no, more cows are going to boil the oceans and then we'll be living in a big sauna planet, then, you know, you need more funding. So we've been selecting over decades in all of these fields for these kinds of sensationist, hysterical, fear-mongering conclusions. So I think that's a big part of it. That's why these people constantly come up with models that suggest catastrophe. There are no models that come up and say, yeah, well, you know what? Things aren't too bad.
Yeah. Right. I know. Yeah, it's... I've been thinking that from the start. And again, I don't have a degree in their fields, but I can read a chart. I can look at what numbers are saying and I can listen to what they're telling me. And I remember, I've pointed this out a number of times, they had Andy Slavitt, who's one of the worst of these people on MSNBC. And they asked him, shouldn't Florida be doing worse than it is, given that they're not really doing any of this stuff and they have a very old population and stuff like that? Shouldn't they be doing much worse? And he admitted that he had no explanation. He said, there are some things about this virus that are a little bit beyond our ability to understand.
We're going to need you to stay home anyway, even though we don't understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're going to need you to stay home anyway, even though we just admitted that we don't understand why people who aren't staying home aren't suffering any problems. And he just goes on to say, but we know that what works, and that is social distancing and whatever, all the other things. But how do you, quote, know that? If by your own admission, you can't explain why people who ignore that seem to be just as good as people who observe it faithfully. How do we, quote, know that? Who's the we? Stop saying we. You think you know that. I don't think we know that. But now they're all selling books, right? Now, that's the other thing, is that they all want to sell a book about the hysteria. Obviously, someday there'll be a full-blown movie about Fauci. We know that. And it'll be the story of the really, really smart guy who was unfortunately put upon by stupid rubes who wouldn't listen to science. The thing writes itself. We already know that. The consolation is that when the Disney people made a documentary about Fauci. It just tanked. Like, just the critics loved it, of course. The general public hated it and in general did not go see it. So that's something.
Yeah. It's actually been quite remarkable. You know, for all the opinion polls and the mainstream news and the kind of noise that you see on Twitter, which is heavily manipulated by the censorship and boosting and deboosting. And yet, when you look at things like movies and books, which are particularly books, you know, you look at the best-selling books on the topic, like all of these, you know, team hysteria actors, all of these people get on TV all the time, and they all promote all of their identically idiotic books, which all basically repeat the same thing, which is, you know, virus is bad, and I am a savior, and you need to stay home and listen to me and engage in the rituals, and then maybe you will be saved. All of these books are identical, and they just still don't get that much of interest from people who read. But you look at the actually popular books on these topics, you know, they're by people like Alex Berenson, who's been wiped off of Twitter, and Robert F. Kennedy, whom you mentioned, whose opinions very widely differ from the ones that you would expect are the dominant mainstream voice. I think it's the experts just have a much bigger sense of self-worth and a much bigger bullhorn. But behind them, I think there's growing number of people that are waking up to just how ridiculous a lot of this is.
Yeah, and they're paper tigers. The fact that we can't recall an example of a genuine debate between a Fauci supporter and a dissident in the medical field on television almost tells you all you need to know. And the fact that Sanjay Gupta goes on Joe Rogan. Now, Joe Rogan's a smart guy, but he doesn't have one of these fancy degrees. He goes on Joe Rogan and he can't hold his own. Imagine if he went up against Koldorf or Bhattacharya or any of the other great people we have. He can't even go up against Joe Rogan without completely folding. He absolutely folded in that interview. He was conceding things left and right. They can't function other than in that bubble, which is why they never emerge from it.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible how none of these people has to ever really justify their ideas. It's a great advertisement for the nature of the fiat system, which I describe in my new book, The Fiat Standard, that everything is dictated by fiat. And so if you're on the expert class, you don't have to ever establish competence. You don't have to justify yourself. You don't have to explain things to people. You know, somebody like Fauci, it's very remarkable how he talks with the tone. And then also Bill Gates, I think those two people in particular are really good at this, which is they talk in a tone of informing you of what you're going to do. They're not even telling you that I'm going to make you do this. And they're not saying, you know, that I've decided this. They're just saying you're going to do this and then you're going to be doing that, completely shortcutting your brain's agency. You know, it's not, you don't have any choice in the matter. And here I'm here to tell you what's going to go down. And, you know, it's been 2 years now and Fauci has not faced a single hostile question from a single reporter anywhere. It's been just handpicked softballs from basically the corporate prostitute press, which is just out there doing what people in power want. It's astonishing.
And all they have to do is that they don't even have to ask him you know, the kinds of things that a Robert F. Kennedy would ask him. They just have to ask him things like, well, you said that once we hit 50% vaccinated, we shouldn't have these outbreaks anymore. And yet there are states that are extremely vaccinated that are having the biggest outbreaks of the whole pandemic. Why do you think that is? The most obvious question in the world. Why do you think you were wrong about that prediction about 50% and there won't be any more outbreaks? What do you think is happening? What did you not know at the time you said that you know now? I'd love to hear the answer, but we're never going to get it because no one will ask him.
Yeah. And, you know, he's changed his mind on masks. He's changed his mind on vaccines. He initially said 100% effective. Now he's equivocating and making all kinds of different claims. But, you know, fiat means never having to explain yourself, never having to say you're sorry, never having to be wrong. You know, you're just correct by fiat because people in authority decree that you are the one that we need to listen to.
Unfortunately, that's where we are. And as this is another reason that, well, here's the thing, because I was going to say that the education system is what encourages people to have this blind trust in authority. But see, here was something that actually genuinely puzzled me about what happened in 2020. You had a mass hysteria to close down the schools and then just to keep them closed and keep them closed and keep them closed. But the schools really are the incubator of conformity. And they want that. The state wants that conformity. And yet, they also were clamoring for keeping the schools closed in a way that was bound to increase the homeschooling population. And indeed, it has. The homeschooling population in the United States has increased substantially. I was wondering why they did that. I mean, I don't actually believe that most of our authority figures seriously bought into the panic. I don't think they really, maybe at the very, very beginning when there were a lot of unknowns, but I was wondering, they're shooting themselves in the foot. This is the institution that takes the independent thought out of people's brains. They can't afford to keep this closed, and if they were fanatical about it. So that I found to be a genuine puzzle.
Yeah. I think, you know, overall, I tend to think it's just a confluence of interests and interest groups that push in certain directions and end up pushing things in certain ways rather than one kind of, top-down orchestrated thing that's driving all of these issues. So I think here, I really do think the element of hysteria, I think I probably disagree with you that I think the vast majority of people did believe it. I think, yes, even the opportunists, I think, genuinely did believe, did fall for the hysteria. Like this was everybody who's easily impressionable, which is the vast majority of people, went along with this. They couldn't even focus on the opportunist aspect. I think if you look at people in the West, everywhere people was really genuinely scared. I think those videos from China really worked. The modeling by the experts worked. The hysteria from the World Health Organization worked. And I think the hysteria took on a life of its own. So there are clearly special interests that are pushing for the hysteria in certain directions. Perhaps it was the Chinese Communist Party pushing for this for certain reasons. Perhaps it was pharmaceutical companies. Different interests pushed in different ways. But I think around early March, this hysteria took on a life of its own. And everybody really went and believed it. And social media and the internet magnified it. You know, it was just pouring fire on this. And then it drove people mad. And they doubled down and went insane with the way things that they did back then. And for most of them, you know, they don't have most people don't have the kind of maturity that you need in order to come to terms with this and accept that you're wrong. And so they're just doubling down. So I think schools were, I think it was just collateral damage for this hysteria that people just really believed their own bullshit so much. And they thought, yeah, well, you know what? Zoom is going to be good enough. We just need to save lives. And if this was purely about status propaganda, then yeah, keeping them in class would be better. But having said that, it's not entirely innocent because, you know, they're not just going to make those kids get homeschooled. A lot of those kids are going to stay home and they're going to be helping alleviate inflationary pressure by not consuming gasoline to transport them to the school and by staying home and not moving around. But a lot of the education is going to be centralized and it's going to be, I think we're going to see more of this, you know, particularly Windows and Bill Gates and basically standardizing curricula and standardizing lectures for students all over the world so that government propaganda will come straight into your house so that taking your kids out of school is not going to save them.
Well, I think the whole issue of schools helped to take a lot of normies who really probably wouldn't have dissented from a Dr. Fauci under ordinary circumstances and woke them up and radicalized them. Because first they realized, all right, this kind of schooling is not any good for my kid, and I can't supervise my kids. I'm supposed to be working all day. And I see that in other states, kids are in school with no ill effects. So why can't we have that in my state? I think that, you know, even though I don't want to defend the public school system, the arguments people had over schooling, I think, did open the eyes of some parents that I can't actually trust the sort of people I thought I used to be able to trust. And I have to fight back against the very sorts of people I thought I could trust. So I am hopeful that in the present moment, now I'm not making a prediction, I have no guarantees, but I'm hopeful that there is a slight turning of the tide here. I mean, obviously there's still tremendous evil going on in the world, and it's going to take a long time to overturn it. But I forget now who it was who broke this down. I should remember the name, but there was some, maybe it's Berenson actually, who said that 30% of America was just going to do whatever the CDC tells them, and it doesn't matter how absurd it is. And there's another 30% that over their dead body are they going to listen to the CDC. They realize it's all political and nonsensical. But that 40%, there are 40% of people who kind of are, you know, they wear the mask because other people are wearing the mask. And if people took them off, they'd be the first one to follow suit. And these are people who might actually be reachable. The people in that 30% who are going to listen to Dr. Fauci, even now, even after all the damage and all the contradictory statements and all the nonsense, that you almost can't reach them. There's nothing you can do. But that 40%, and I think that 40% may be turning. There's some interesting polling data about independents and how they feel about Biden and the pandemic and shutdowns and masks. And so I'm hopeful that, especially now that they're saying now you have to get the booster, there are places where you have to get the booster. They're going to make it hard for you to live your life even without the booster. New York is now saying that in order to participate in society, if you're age 5 and up, you have to get the vaccine. So that means they can't have international tourism anymore because you can't even get, even if you wanted to, you couldn't get the vaccine for 5-year-olds in other countries. We're seeing that being introduced in Chicago also, where they're going to introduce, you have to be, also Boston, just the other day, you have to be vaccinated, proof of vaccination to get into basic things. And they're even saying in Boston that by March or so, that's going to extend to 5-year-olds. That's going to cut off international tourism for Boston also. And it will also severely reduce domestic tourism. It severely undercuts the clientele for basically every business. Now it's true. I didn't think this craziness could go on this long, but that kind of thing, I don't see how businesses survive it. And I don't see how it just persists forever. And you do now see some vaccinated people saying, this is completely out of hand. Now I have to get the booster in order to be able to do anything. This is not what I was promised. And now we're having lockdowns on top of it. I saw a Reddit thread from Canada, and not a libertarian thread, just a flat out plain Jane Canadian thread about some lockdown somewhere. And they're all saying, look, we've had it. You are sucking away the very last bits of joy anyone can expect to get in this world. And we've done everything you asked of us. This is ridiculous. I think there is indication of somewhat of a turn, but where are the political figures who will unambiguously stand up in favor of this side of things? There aren't nearly as many as there ought to be, but if there were, they might not win. It's true, but there are a lot of people prepared to flock to them right now, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one is DeSantis in Florida, who's been an absolute miracle in.
Thank goodness for him
resisting this. Yeah, it's I've been to Florida recently, and it's a very welcome change from the rest of the world, and they're not witnessing mass death. But the political aspect of capitalizing on this seems to be, I don't know, it's been almost 2 years, and I still think it's still not it still does not look to be a political winner for somebody to take it on. It doesn't look like there's going to be a, you know, an anti-hysteria populist politician who's going to win on this. But it is becoming more likely with every day.
Yeah, but on the other hand, we had a very interesting, you know, in Virginia, the governor who won, he wasn't like a DeSantis, but he beat the Democrat, and it was quite clear that he was not going to be as mandate crazy as that Democrat. New Jersey is a very blue state, and their governor almost got voted out, which was very surprising. And then now the guy who's the head of the state legislature, he's just a random guy who defeated the political machine Democrat. He's a random guy who just paid the filing fee to run, didn't really do anything, raised about $120, spent most of it at Waffle House, did nothing to campaign, and he won. So I think there are little indications. And yeah, it's true that as on a national level, people might not be ready, but there are states where it's brewing. And the great thing about DeSantis is that he doesn't just do the right thing, which would be good enough, but he is great at being in command of the science and the literature and the scholarly work. He knows it and he can refer to it. And he is, he's punchy. He is pugilistic, let's say, right? He fights back. When the media goes after him, he immediately hits back. Or he gets a hostile question from a reporter, he turns it around on them and asks and starts asking them questions. Okay, do you know what the circumstances were in that county, that why we had to do it that way? Do you know any of the background? And he'll make them squirm in their seat. And he said, well, I'll tell it to you. Here's what you should have known if you'd researched this before you asked me the question. He takes nothing from anybody. I don't say that I agree with him on every issue, but he is the kind of guy I have wished would exist, who knows the stuff and won't take anything from anybody and calls out bad actors and rallies the disenfranchised around the country to him. People who feel like they are voiceless, he stands up and ridicules the people who are taking their voices away. And he's done a tremendous job for that reason.
I agree. And I still think, though, I think the common theme to all of the seminars we have in this podcast is, if things are good, it's because of Bitcoin. If things are bad, if we see anything that's bad, then, well, at least Bitcoin fixes this. And I think really the solution to all of these things is Bitcoin. As I was saying earlier, it's like with my internet presence, I'm taking the performance enhancement drugs that is Bitcoin. I think the liberty case, the liberty cause around the world is going to be massively boosted by Bitcoin. And this is a great example of it. Bitcoin fixes the COVID hysteria on so many levels. First level is, you know, on a direct level, people who become financially independent with Bitcoin can't be canceled financially. So it's going to allow more people to create more content and produce more research and get paid and not get blacklisted from being able to monetize themselves, which because nobody can blacklist you from Bitcoin. And then on the other hand, perhaps more importantly and more long-term, it's going to defund the money printer that is financing all of these fiat sciences. You know, all of these silly pseudosciences like epidemiology and all of the insanity that they produce is a result of the fact that these people are massively subsidized by government money. And Bitcoin takes all of that away. So I think, you know, in the medium term, in the short term, it does look pretty bleak. The world just keeps getting worse. And governments are utilizing technologies in ways that are just extremely dangerous. And we're only just beginning to understand the depths of how devastating what they're doing is. But I think, you know, with every new invention, with every new technological invention, there's the good side of it and there's the bad side of it. And what Bitcoin is going to do, the good side of it, is going to massively liberate people all over the world from this kind of insanity. And I think it's...
The key thing is that it helps us build something parallel to the clown show that we live in now. I mean, we obviously need to be building a lot of parallel institutions. I mean, you and I teach online. We don't teach in traditional academic settings, but that doesn't make the information that we convey any less important or effective, effectively transmitted. So we're building for our audiences a parallel institution there. And likewise, it seems like so obviously money is the ultimate institution for which we need a parallel so that we can secede monetarily and in other ways from the regime that's given us what we see around us today. It's hard work to build parallel institutions, but honestly, you know, there ain't enough room for both of us in this town seems to be the lesson that we're drawing from this. I don't want to be part of a society with people who would so cavalierly throw people's lives away like this, or who would, without even bothering to look into it, would just blindly accept a Fauci or any of the other people, or for that matter, a Jerome Powell or an Alan Greenspan. I want parallel institutions where people like us who care about freedom and property and independence can live a satisfying life without feeling threatened by a self-appointed expert class. And if Bitcoin can contribute to that, which I think it can, then it is the right thing at the right time.
I certainly hope so. I certainly think so. And I think we're seeing the budding shoots of the Bitcoin-based world. I think we're just beginning to see this world emerge around it. And I think it's very telling that, and I said this when I was discussing the same issue with Jeff Deist. It's quite remarkable how the Mises Institute and people who are into proper Austrian economics almost all coalesced around the non-hysterical interpretation of what's going on. People in their own personal lives might have had different risk approaches to this, different approaches to this risk. You know, some people might have decided to use masks, take medications. Different people will have tried different things. But if you've studied Austrian economics, if you're familiar with it, you pretty much almost always came to the conclusion that this is something that should be left to individuals and governments shouldn't be locking people at home. They shouldn't be shutting the businesses down. And it's on one hand, it's encouraging and heartening that we see this. And, there is a sane way of understanding how the world actually works. And it's good because you're witnessing this kind of new coalition emerge around these issues of people who just are not bound by, to copy a phrase of yours, you know, your favorite phrase on the card, the 3x5
card? Index card of allowable opinion, yeah.
Yes, the index card of allowable opinion. On many more issues, people who are outside those index cards end up coalescing around these main ideas. So monetary freedom, intellectual freedom, and now increasingly medical freedom as well. And I think we're witnessing the internet is giving this little small world wings, basically, because now, you know, we can communicate. People can communicate their heretical ideas about those things, but they can also finance it. They can also monetize it, and they can do that independently of all fiat financial institutions. So I think this space has a lot of room to grow into the future.
Well, as I say, that it could well be the right technology at the right time, because I mean, how long has it been in existence? I mean, just less my daughters lived in a world without Bitcoin. That's how young it is. And yet it so happens that it has emerged at the exact moment when freedom-loving people around the world need it the most.
Agreed. Well, on that very positive note, our time is coming up to an end. Thank you so very much for your time, for joining us, for the inspiration, and for everything that you do on Austrian economics and on educating the world about liberty and about the coronavirus hysteria.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks very much for what you do as well.
Cheers. Have a good day.
All right, everybody. That is another week of Tom Woods Show episodes. Our friend Ian Miller is going to be returning to the program next week. Ian is the author of a brand new book where he takes a lot of his great charts. He's been particularly good on the masking topic, but he's been great on lockdowns and all these other things. And he has all these amazing charts comparing one place with another, and they have completely different masking habits, and yet they have the same result or this and that. He's been so, so good on that. I've shared so many of his charts, and he's combined them into a book. So we're going to be talking about that. He'll be one of my guests next week. So make sure and join me. Now, if you are on, let's see. No, I guess I did put all my episodes on YouTube this week. But don't forget my Odyssey channel, tomwoods.com/vid, for the occasional episode that I would rather just release there for reasons that I hope will be obvious. All right, everybody. See you next week. Thank you so much.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.